Ave podcast listeners, as you may have heard this year, Emperors of Rome is now a listener-supported podcast, complete with a shiny Patreon account. You can find out more by going to patreon.com/Rome Podcast. To give you a taste of what you could be hearing, this month there is a bonus podcast with archaeologist Peter Guest. He's talking about the discovery and identification of coins of Carausius, which will become very relevant to today's episode. So just as a teaser, I'll put a clip from that bonus episode at the end of this one. If you'd like to hear the whole thing, please give your support. Thanks. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Center for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCLII, Reclaiming Britannia. Constantius was elevated to Caesar with one primary mission: retake Britannia for the Roman Empire. In the latter half of the 4th century, the province of Britannia and parts of Western Gaul had retained a stubborn sort of independence, flying in the face of a unified Rome. If the Tetrarchy were to prove they were a stable system, this had to come to an end. Here's Kaelin Davenport. So we will start this episode with Constantius, who has been largely appointed for and left with the problem of Carausius in Britain.
Yes, that's right, Matt. So Constantius is put to work very quickly, actually, to besiege Carausius's last foothold on Gallic soil, and that is ancient Gisoriacum, the modern-day port of Boulogne. So you may remember that Carausius has been a problem since 286, and Maximian's attempts to launch a fleet to recapture Britain has failed, and that there's been a lot of to and fro over the territory of northern Gaul. But at this point, Carausius is hanging on to this one city, and certainly we know Constantius is made Caesar on 1st of March 293, and by that same summer, the same year, he is besieging Boulogne.
I want to say that's really quickly, but this would have been a continuation of the military campaign in some ways, isn't it? It's just with a new title for him.
Exactly. Like, he'd been a senior general already. He was probably, I mean, this is all quite hypothetical, but the evidence of panegyrics of the period that praise his son Constantine do talk a bit about Constantius's early career, and a lot of the anecdotes seem to focus on him and the German tribes and the Rhine frontier. But certainly the campaign against Carausius has been ongoing under Maximian, and so a considerable amount of Roman forces have been devoted to this. What I'd say the swiftness shows us is that basically Constantius was raised to Caesar to deal with this problem. So that was his key mission.
And so our best record of what happens here is these panegyrics that you've been discussing.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, there are small excerpts from Eutropius, Aurelius Victor, these other historians who wrote these abbreviated histories. But, you know, the best thorough account comes from the panegyrics, particularly in this case, one delivered in 297 in Constantius's honor in Trier. It was probably associated with his triumph over Britain once he was successful. And certainly we know, as part of these celebrations, gifts would be distributed to soldiers, and then also speeches praising the emperor would be delivered. And the orator tells us a bit about himself at the beginning. You know, he is a former imperial official who's accompanied emperors before, so he's someone that's in the know. And of course, you know, this is a one-sided view. We don't have the viewpoint of Carausius or his successor, Allectus. But when we combine the panegyrics with the accounts of Eutropius and Aurelius Victor, we do get the sense that, you know, not everything always went smoothly for Constantius. And perhaps the real credit belongs to someone else for the conclusion of the campaign.
Wow, for that to come out of the panegyrics, things must have really gone bad and been sanded over a bit. So what do they tell us then?
Well, so, you know, first it is this siege of Boulogne, and it's clear that Carausius isn't there himself, that he is in Britain, and that Constantius essentially blockades the point with a mole in order to stop ships getting out, but also to stop Carausius and his forces bringing relief. So I'm now going to quote from this panegyric of 297. The reference is 6.2 within that panegyric. So it's panegyric 8, and it's chapter 6, section 2. Because I know we have, you know, lots of really engaged listeners who like to look this stuff up afterwards. And the orator says to Constantius, "You rendered the whole bay of the port, where at fixed intervals the tide ebbs and flows, impassable to ships by driving piles at its entrance and sinking boulders there. You thereby overcame the very nature of the place with remarkable ingenuity, since the sea, moving back and forth in vain, seemed to make sport, as it were, of those to whom escape was denied, and offered as little practical help to those shut in as if it had ceased to ebb at all." So, you know, real focus here on the sea, the ocean. Listeners may remember back in the earlier episodes how much mastery over the sea and ocean mattered to Carausius and his public image. You know, he had been a helmsman in his youth, and his coinage really promoted his mastery over sea and over ocean, I should say, as well. This is the English Channel, so people might think, oh, it's not really that big. But, you know, to the Romans, you know, ever since Julius Caesar, this has been the crossing of ocean, you know, the ends of the known world. This was a really big achievement. And so, you know, the mole is preventing Carausius to come and rescue his forces. The panegyrist goes on to boast that the ocean now obeyed Constantius because, and I quote section 7.2, "his plan did not insult the element," that is the sea, "so that it did not provoke its hatred, but earned its respectful compliance." So the idea is that, you know, the sea is not opposed, that the sea gives in to Constantius, and, you know, the siege is a success.
Yeah, it's interesting to see just practically as well how a blockade is working. So this cuts off essentially Carausius from the mainland, really.
That's right. So this is certainly a big blow to his prestige, because beginning he seems to have controlled quite a bit of northern Gaul. So, you know, he's really being pushed back here. So this had some unexpected consequences, or perhaps expected consequences, depending on how you put it. So,
third century consequences are expected.
Are expected. Yeah. Murder is going to happen. It's probable that during the siege of Boulogne, when Carausius isn't able to rescue his troops, he's actually murdered. Murdered that summer of 293 by one of his subordinates called Alectus. We know virtually nothing about Alectus beyond his name. His name suggests Celtic Germanic origin. He may have held a senior position like Praetorian prefect to Carausius, we don't know. The panegyrists describe him as Carausius's sateles, so like we might say satellite today, you know, associate or henchman, if we want to put a sort of a more nefarious spin on it. You know, the panegyrists are very negative, obviously, about both Carausius and Alectus, and, you know, they're referred to as brigands, outlaws, and Alectus is referred to as the brigand's standard bearer. But otherwise, we know basically nothing about him, and his coinage isn't nearly as interesting as Carausius's. So, you know, all those wonderful, you know, scenes and Virgilian allusions that we have on Carausius's coins don't continue. But it's clear that, you know, Carausius had failed, and so he needed to be replaced.
So Alectus does take over, in his own mind at least, the same level of seniority that Carausius claimed, doesn't he?
Yep, he's acclaimed Augustus, and he holds the office of consul in 294, probably inaugurated in Londinium. He mints gold coinage to pay his troops, not silver, mainly gold, probably to show, you know, he has access to funds still. There is archaeological evidence from London that he does, you know, start constructions on like some sort of palace complex there. So there's the sense that, you know, he's bedding in for some time.
But for the Tetrarchy and for Constantius, Britannia is an outlier. This is unfinished business for them. So the next point would be to reconquer that as well.
Yeah, definitely. But they don't rush things. So Boulogne falls, you know, 293. The actual invasion of Britain doesn't happen until 296. The panegyrics give us a bit of an idea of what Constantius is up to. He actually engages on campaigns in the northwestern provinces, particularly Batavia, which is where Carausius came from, as well as, you know, the Franks. And this is really to ensure that these people don't support Electus by wearing them down, taking their children, etc., that they're not going to support Electus. We know that Electus has Frankish mercenaries on his side. So this seems an attempt in order for Constantius to protect his flank. Again, Panegyric 8, chapter 8.4, you know, talks about Constantius' campaigns. And he says, "But neither the treacherous nature of this region, nor the very many refuge which were to be found in its forests, could protect the barbarians from being compelled to give themselves up en masse to the control of your divinity." There's this real sense here that, you know, Constantius is like a living god, you know, he's subduing them and, you know, protecting his rear so these people don't sort of sweep from behind. It will support Electus.
I guess the other point in this time is that invading Britannia is a step up in any sort of campaign. So he would need to build the ships to get over there. You're going to need a lot of troops to cover that territory.
That's exactly right. And you might remember that Maximian's fleet had been destroyed when he tried to do that earlier. So, you know, you have to have a plan, but you also need to have a backup plan as well. So you need to build enough ships that if, you know, some are destroyed or get lost, you still have enough that are going to make the crossing. So it's clear that they're prepared to wait in order to do this well. And that's why the invasion doesn't take place until 296.
All right, so in these 2 years, I guess Electius is making preparations himself. So what does the invasion look like? What do we know about it?
Yes, so it's a two-pronged attack. Constantius gets all the credit from the panegyrist, understandably, he's the emperor. There are references to other generals doing things, but they're not named. But we know from Aurelius Victor and Eutropius that one of the divisions, in fact, the most successful one, was actually led by the Praetorian prefect. And this is Iulius Asclepiodotus. Now, he is Maximian's Praetorian prefect because there's only two prefects in the empire at the time, one in the west, one in the east. But he seems to have been seconded to Constantius for this campaign. As I said, the orator, you know, elides this. Constantius is, you know, the sole leader. He says, chapter 14.3 of the speech, "But you, invincible Caesar, were the commander-in-chief of that whole expedition of yours, both of the actual sailing and the fighting itself, not only by the right of your imperium, but also by your personal participation. And by example of your firm resolve, you were its instigator and driving force." So this really emphasizes the importance of, you know, leadership from the front when it comes to emperors. But we know that Constantius commanded only one half of the fleet, which sailed from Boulogne, and Asclepiodotus commanded the other half, which departed from the mouth of the River Seine.
Well, in his defense, it would be hard to command all of that fleet leaving from two different locations, so...
of course, you know, and he would need support, but it's what happens next, which is very curious. It's not his fault, but, you know, it would have been nice for Asclepiodotus to get a bit more of the credit. Because what happens is there's terrible weather in the English Channel. And then we don't hear again of Constantius's forces until the very end. We don't know what happens.
Wow, okay. Constantius doesn't go down with his ship or anything, so lost on the way kind of thing.
I think they get lost. Yeah, no, they're still there because they make an appearance right at the end. You know, the fleet isn't destroyed like happens with Maximian's fleet, but I think they get lost. We are told there's a lot of fog and they just don't get to the right place.
Meanwhile,
yes, Asclepiodotus and his forces land on the Isle of Wight. So they make it there. And here the fog is very helpful to them because Alectus's troops don't spot them. And then he burns their ships, presumably as a sign of confidence. You know, we're going to win this battle. We're not going back. Alectus marches to meet Asclepiodotus' forces in battle. Where? We don't know. Somewhere in the south of England. Alectus's troops, we have Frankish mercenaries as well as Romans, which meant that the Panegyrists could betray them all as barbarians. So, you know, this is a justified war because they're all foreigners. And I love the way the panegyrist glosses over the fact that Constantius isn't there for this battle against Alectus. He said, chapter 15.6, that Alectus preferred to make trial of your generals than to receive in person the thunderbolt of your majesty. Mm. So the idea is, you know, oh, well, this is the one here. I don't want to have to deal with Constantius. So, you know, I'll try to deal with this general.
Yeah, there also seems to be an effort to kind of smooth things over.
Very much so. And Alectus dies in the battle and he's found dead. And the orator says in 16.4, among them lay the brigand's standard bearer. Of his own accord, he had discarded the apparel which he had profaned when alive. And he was discovered on the evidence of barely a single garment. So I think this refers to, you know, him no longer has his Roman military uniform, you know, that he betrayed that while alive, that he was, you know, left as the evil barbarian that he was.
Okay. And then Constantius turns up.
Yes. So they found their way. You know, they've nowhere to land. And the main battle, we don't know what happens because the panegyrist, you know, lies over that. You know, his forces are there. They sack London and they slaughter Alectus's supporters. Mm.
Wow. I wonder if that's the positive version for Constantius, what it actually may have looked like.
I think they got rather embarrassingly lost.
Yeah. So at this point, Britain is, not that it probably ever officially left, but welcome back into the empire, isn't it?
That's exactly right. So Carausius and Lectus had portrayed themselves as legitimate Roman emperors, but to Diocletian and co, they were rebels, they were barbarians, they were bandits. And so the panegyrist has sort of some wonderful terms of phrase when, you know, he talks about the way in which, you know, the Britons were saved. He says in 19.2, they were free at last. At last, Romans, at last restored to life by the true light of empire.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, they never stopped being Romans, but they still got sacked like they were an enemy. It must be quite a whiplash for the people there. You know, in some ways, nothing would change other than who's on the coin.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there is, you know, there is slaughter, that there is punishment, but then it's being betrayed like they're being rescued.
Mm. Yeah.
So your rescuers, you know, don't sack your city.
So how does Constantius use this victory? How does he show that it happens? And I guess following on from something that you said in the last episode, that for the Tetrarchs, this is a joint victory for everyone as well.
That's right. Yes. So Constantius achieves it, or really Asclepiodotus as well. But yes, so it's a title for all of them. They all become Britannicus Maximus, so the greatest conqueror of Britain. It's perfectly acceptable now to use victories in civil wars as a title. And, you know, it features prominently on medallions that are minted, really expensive gold medallions. So these are worth multiple aurei, so worth 5 aurei and 10 aurei gold medallions. Many of them have been found in hoards, which were the property of officers. So they're probably given out to military officers. And the most famous of these is the 10 aurei Arras medallion, which was named after where it was found as part of a hoard in 1922. And the obverse of this medallion, so the head side, features the portrait of Constantius, whereas the reverse depicts Constantius on horseback approaching Britannia, who is kneeling, her hands outstretched in sort of welcome to the Caesar Constantius before the walls of Londinium. And the image is accompanied by the Latin legend Reditor Lucis Aeternae, the restorer of eternal light. So this is really fascinating. The same image of light that features in the panegyrics also features in the coinage as well. So this must have been sort of some coherent idea that the imperial administration wanted to promote. We also find it used in subsequent panegyrics, such as that by Eumenius in 298, who says that Britain emerged to the sight of the Roman light. The iconography is also fascinating because under Hadrian, there's this idea of him visiting all the provinces and he minted coins with his hand outstretched, raising up the provinces with legends such as Restitutor, so Restitutor Hispaniae, the restorer of Spain, and some even, with armies. But he was just visiting all the regions, whereas Constantius has conquered. So this idea that, Britain is kneeling before him, subjugated, and that, his victory is raising them up again. But as you said, it's a very brutal liberation.
Yeah. I've just looked up the medallion. There's a picture of one on the British Museum website. They pack a lot of information into such a small medallion. I mean, it's got the ships there going across the ocean. They don't look lost in the fog, but at least they're there. Constantius on his horse, and there's Britannia kneeling and the walls of London. It's got it all.
Yes. It's really amazing. If anyone goes to the British Museum, make sure to check it out, because it's clearly, a lot of work has gone into this. Quite right, he's on horseback, he's above the ship. You have Lon, L-O-N, showing that it's Londinium, the walls there. Britannia stretches her arms out. So it's obviously been carefully put all the pieces together. Mm. And, Constantius is shown armed as well. He has a giant spear. When Hadrian was raising up provinces, it wasn't quite as martial there. And it's very likely these were given out to military officers who participated in the campaign against Britain. And I think that that's really important, because Carausius himself, we don't really know about electors, but Carausius, who started this whole business, he was a military officer. That he was just like Diocletian and Maximian and Constantius and Galerius. And so I think it's really important that the tetrarchs and their imagery send a message, to their other military officers that, hey, you're on our team. We're rewarding you with these beautiful, valuable gold medallions for your role in the campaign. But also there's a slight undercurrent of, and don't you think about trying it yourselves.
And this is a sort of message that I guess they communicate around the entire empire as well.
Yes, so they take the title Britannicus Maximus. Also, the rostra in the Roman Forum is remodeled. And of course, this is really important because, of course, the rostra takes its name from the prows of the ships that were captured at the Battle of Antium in 338 BCE, so a long time ago. But of course, it's the speaker's platform. So it is associated with naval victories. So there's remodeling of the rostra, and it's possibly at this time that four columns of the tetrarchs and a fifth with Jupiter are then put up on the rostra as well to associate them with this victory. And the Arch of Galerius at Thessaloniki, which I think we've done a whole episode
that was,
on.
That was when in Rome, yeah.
This arch, which we'll talk about again in future episodes, the conquest of Galerius' war against Persia, shows the tetrarchs enthroned over the entire world. So, recapturing Britain as well as their victory against Persia is really important for the message of world domination, that, under their sway, the tetrarchs have control all the way from Britain to the east.
Is that imagery as well evoked in those porphyry statues that you were talking about in the Vatican? Because you mentioned globes in that as well.
Yeah, definitely. The idea of the globes, the control of the world. And we also think that this is part of the imperial scepters. Maxentius's scepter that was found in Rome relatively recently has a globe as well. So, and this comes through in the panegyrics, the idea that because there are emperors everywhere, that they can control the four corners of the known world.
Got the whole world in my hands. There's an interesting tangent here that you've written down for Asclepiodotus. His story doesn't quite end.
Yes, so he is remembered. Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing in the 12th century in the medieval period, in chapter 4, has this wonderful story about how, you know, Alectus fights with Carausius, kills him, but then the Britons, unhappy, they make Asclepiodotus, who is here, Duke of Cornwall, to be their king. And then he marches against Alectus in London, and then he is victorious. So I love this idea that, you know, Constantius is written out of events, but, you know, Asclepiodotus's, you know, this Praetorian prefect gets his moment to shine in the medieval period.
It also seems to say that, you know, this overthrowing of Alectus was actually Britain's idea the entire time.
But I love the fact that, you know, Constantius is like, no, we're not going to mention him. But then, you know, he clearly made a mark in British folklore.
Yes, yes. Take that, being minted on a coin. Ha.
Exactly.
That was Professor Caelan Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. Emperors of Rome is a listener-supported podcast. You can find out more by going to patreon.com/Rome Podcast, where there is now a new bonus episode in which I speak to archaeologist Peter Guest about the identification of some coins of Carausius.
Carausius's message was basically, you stick with me, I'm going to make sure that everybody is safe and secure. And the way I'm going to do that is by reviving good old-fashioned Roman values and making sure that the army are strong, because without a strong army, the rest of it will all fall apart. So it's a very conservative message, and he goes back not just a decade or two, but some of his coins seem to be going back to the days of Augustus and the end of the Republic, looking for symbols and images and messages that represent the Roman Golden Age that Carausius is claiming that he's going to revive in Roman Britain.
If you'd like to hear the full interview, it's now available. Go to patreon.com/Rome Podcast. This podcast was recorded and produced in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. And that's it for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.